Hi, Dan.
Hi, Jason.
What you doing?
Downloading MP3 files of one of the podcasts I run in the hopes that I'll have copies of all of them if the place they're hosted goes under, as it might.
I've been there.
Yeah, so I've done just archiving. I have most of them, but I realized I don't have ones. There are several episodes of The Rebound that I was not on just because I was away or not available. And so I'm going through and making sure I have all of the copies, which did turn up at least one interesting point where in one of the folders I had somehow inadvertently ended up with duplicates of a bunch of episodes because I put them in one of the subfolders. And I was like, wait, there's 10 episodes in here that I already have elsewhere. So that's exciting. Deduping files. The best.
Yeah, I did that. I did that with Clockwise, where I downloaded all of the Clockwise files from SoundCloud when we left IDG, and then I did that with Incomparable, where I was making sure I had a complete library of the files that were going up to 5x5 in case that, or really, it was at that point, it was when I left 5x5. So, same story. That it's good to have, good to keep your own copy. I would do, if it was easier to do that, I would do that with all of the stuff I've written for various websites too. But
yeah,
at that point,
really difficult.
I'm kind of like, I try to keep the text of those stories around and, you know, and then kind of throw yourself on the Internet Archive for the rest, I suppose.
Right. Plus, I mean, I end up with text of the stories, but sometimes they get edited, right? So
sure.
You don't have the final version.
By monsters.
Yeah, monsters. That's the same thing with my book. I don't currently have So I have a Scrivener file
right.
That is like my book, but I don't have the Scrivener file that is consistent with the version that's actually published because all that editing was done in Word. And so there's no really easy way to grab that and turn it back into mesh it.
Do you not have the Word file?
I have some of the Word files. I'm not sure I have the one that is actually 100%. And even there were changes that were made there have been updates since then.
And so here's my question, which is, you have the copyright on the book and your publisher has rights, right?
Correct.
Are there edits part of your copyright?
That's a great question. I honestly, that would be a question for my agent.
Yeah.
I really don't know. So, I would assume because the book itself should say copyright me.
Yes.
So I would assume that everything that's in there is under my copyright and they simply have a license to print it.
Yeah, I guess that's my question is, do you have it? Because if you have the rights to their copy edits of your book, I mean, you probably should have a copy anyway of the final.
Sure, right.
Whatever the final is, or something you could maybe deem as final, because you totally should have a reference copy of that for you. Because, you know, you're working on a sequel, and how do you consult the original? Let me get my paperback copy out.
I definitely have done that, but it's certainly less convenient in a lot of cases where it's like, well, I can't run find and replace or just find on a paperback copy. That's a lot harder.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's one of those things that's like been on my list to do is like email my editor and be like, hey, can you send me a copy of the most current version of the Word file? And then maybe I can re-import it into Scrivener or something, like just start a new Scrivener document basically and just dump it all in and then slice it up the way that I want it sliced up.
I would think that you should be able to do that. You might
perhaps low on my priority list these days.
That's true. Just having a reference point is probably good though, I would think.
Yeah, no, I agree.
I'm doing what I always do, which is get files dropped in a Dropbox by people who are on a podcast and then do my, so even so you guys played an Incomparable game show yesterday. A little peek behind the veil of that. And, I wasn't on that. And normally I collect the files and I do the master recording. So you sent me your call recorder file, which contains both your microphone file, which I need for the final version, and your what you heard on Skype, which is a great reference point because that's everybody else's voices. And I can merge that together and create an MP3 for the members of The Incomparable. That's a bootleg version. And I use it as reference to sync up all the tracks, because that's what I do, is everybody sends me their own recording, but they all started at different times and at different times. And then I use some software that is not publicly available to sync it up. And then I run it through some denoising stuff in a program called Isotope RX6. And then in this case, I will then just send those files to our friend Stephen Shapansky in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, and he will actually edit.
Outsourcing
edit
it to
episode.
Canada, yes, as all good things
I
are.
I am outsourcing podcast production to Canada. So that's what I was doing this morning, is I turned on the computer for the first time since you guys did that thing. I'd already shut down by the time you guys did. So it synced all these huge files over, and now I'm synchronizing them and all, and then I'll run the denoising on them. And that makes my iMac chug, let me tell you. Woo! The fan comes on. It's very impressive. The denoising plugin in Isotope will use all four cores at 100% to remove the noise. But it is, that program is amazing. It's got, who did I turn onto it? I turned Marco Arment onto it. I turned Stephen Hackett onto it. It's like, it does, I wrote a 6-color piece about it a while ago with some samples, including an amazing sample, because one of the things it does is de-reverb. And James Thompson was doing, it was the Doctor Who Christmas special, and his mother-in-law was staying with him, so he had to record the episode because it's like 2 in the morning or whatever. When we recorded that episode, he'd do it in his kitchen, which is super echoey. And I used the de-reverb plugin, and the sample is on that 6 colors story. And it's just, that de-reverb plugin is amazing. It just, the echo just goes away. I mean, it's not perfect, but it's so much better. So I can de-echo people in echoey rooms. The noise removers are amazing, where you've got like a fan or an air conditioner. Broadband hums, there's a hum remover, but also you can do, like, if somebody's got like a fairly constant street noise and you've got a fairly long chunk of, like, this is what their street noise sounds like behind them. They got a window open or something like that. It takes that stuff out. It can take crowd noise out in a live setting pretty effectively. It's kind of amazing. And then it's got a bunch of other little things. Like, I had a podcast where somebody was, they had taken their pop filter off their microphone for a TV appearance, and then they forgot to put it back on, and they're popping their peas throughout. And there's a deplosive plugin that just fixes that. There's a declip plugin that if your volume is too high and your microphone clips, that takes the really bad sound out of the clip and makes it sound like it didn't clip. It's amazing. So it costs $300 or something. It's not for everybody, but it is. I process so many audio files now. It is staggering. But I will say this. I have that i7 2015 iMac, and it is like we played D&D right on Sunday, 4.5 hour long audio files from like 5 or 6 people. Let me tell you that even on a 4 gigahertz i7 iMac with all 4 cores firing at 100%, it takes a very long time to process a bunch of 4.5 hour long audio files. So what I'm saying is, I'm glad I have a fast iMac, because, and this is the thing that makes me dream. I think it's inappropriate for most of my workload, but I do think about like an iMac Pro or a Mac Pro specifically because of this stuff, because I'm denoising stuff all the time, and it ends up sounding great. And hopefully people notice. Maybe they don't, but I notice how bad the files sound when I get them, so I'm very happy to run them through that process.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of those programs that's like, will basically take as much horsepower as you have, right? Like, yes. We'll use it all. Whatever you got, we'll use it.
Some of their plugins will only run on 1 core, but there are a few of them that are properly multi-core, and it's great. It's a little bit like, because Marco Arment is obsessed with multi-core, as he should be, because it's like, why would you do processor intensive stuff on a single core if you've got 4 cores on your computer, or 2 even. And so like his MP3 encoder that he's been working on, which I have a beta of, Forecast, he wrote his own parallelization scheme for MP3 encoding. So when you encode an MP3 in that app, Your fans spin up and it pins the processors to 100%, and then it's done in a quarter of the time as if it was using one core on a four core system. It's pretty great. So there are those moments, where when it's working at its full effectiveness, where, it's pretty incredible. Also, yeah, I'm reminded that my iMac is the slower SSD. So, like, your iMac's got the faster, the 2X SSD. Mine's got the slower one, and that bites me because these files are huge. And then I choose save, and I just sit there, and it very slowly saves the file out. And that makes me sad. But, you know.
Yeah, I've had a lot of people email me over the past couple weeks since I wrote that thing about, you know, my new iMac, asking me for purchasing advice and what I thought of it. And, you know, there's a lot of interest in it. It's hard to be a unequivocal recommender of it, because although it's a perfectly great piece of hardware, as you've said, not everybody needs that much power, right? Like, you're going to pay for the processing power that you get in there. And if that's what you need, you know, I had somebody talk to me, it was writing in about doing, you know, 4K video editing or whatever. It's like, yeah, if you're doing 4K video editing, you probably want as much horsepower as you can throw at that thing. But if you're doing, you know, if it weren't for podcast editing, I would not need this machine, honestly. I might want this machine, but there would be no real justification, because I don't do enough other tasks that are intensive enough that it's worth the price.
Right.
But at this point, you know, and especially for me, as I was like speccing out stuff and realizing the jump to the top end processor was not as much as I thought from like the mid range, I decided, you know, there's a combination of A, it's great to have the horsepower for the production stuff I do, and B, future proofing to whatever extent you can. You just buy the fastest processor you can get and hope that it lasts a lot longer. So if I can get, you know, the number of years I got out of my old iMac, which was, I think, pretty close to the top of the line when I got it, then this machine will have served me pretty well.
That's right. I think that's exactly right. That's the way to approach it, is if you can pay for the upgrade, then you should. You know, you hear from a lot of people who are shopping for these things, it's like, oh, I don't really. It's like, if you've got a budget, you've got a budget. That's just what it is. But I do believe that, not every time, but a lot of times, if you play that game of I'm gonna max it out or get as high up in the level as I can, thing's gonna last longer, so that defers your next purchase longer, and in the end, it's a good investment. Plus, you get that much power, but you gotta actually apply that power, right? Which, you know, you as a writer don't need to apply that power,
sure,
but
right.
You as a podcast editor. And you've gone from, there was a time when you didn't edit podcasts, and now you're editing Clockwise and the Rebound.
I don't remember those days, Jason.
Clockwise, the Rebound, and do you do the Aerocast too when you do that?
I do the Aerocast, and I do Not Playing, and I do Inconceivable
when I do it.
So, I mean, I edit a lot of podcasts.
You edit a lot of podcasts now. Look at you.
Yeah, so it's a big chunk of my life. So
welcome
at that
to
point,
my world.
Yep, it's worth the power. It's worth the power.
I got a suggestion for you, Dan.
What's
Canada.
That? I hear good things. I understand they give you a whole bunch of Legos when you come in too, so that's pretty great.
Yeah, I did. I mean, I think I mentioned this. It may even be obliquely on the Free Agents podcast, but one of the things I did that actually really improved my quality of life as an independent worker was realize I didn't need to edit every single podcast that I was doing.
Yeah.
And through some work at Stephen and Erica in Canada, and also to Jim Metzendorf, who's in the US of A as freelance editors for some of the stuff. I still edit The Incomparable, and I edit Download and Free Agents, but most of the other, like Game Show and Total Party Kill. Oh, I do TV Talk Machine again. Not much of an edit there, but like the Game Show and Total Party Kill, I divested myself of editing those, and I'm much happier.
It doesn't scale, right? Like, you know, if you're doing, even for me, I do maybe three or four shows a week that I end up editing. Mostly, you know, 2 to 3 shows a week that I end up editing, really. And that's fine. None of those take me particularly long, especially because none of them are long shows. None of them are longer than an hour.
Right.
And so, you know, in some ways, Clockwise, as we probably discussed in the past, is the most challenging because it has a hard time limit, right? Like, so yesterday, for example, I did an episode that went 5 minutes over. And that, as you well know, trying to excise 5 minutes from that show is very difficult because you don't, there's rarely like a solid minute you can just take out, right? Like a lot of times it's dribs and drabs. It's 30 seconds here, 20 seconds there. And so that's actually the most challenging, even though it's the shortest show that I edit. So, you know, between that and the other shows that I edit every week, it's not super arduous, but you do throw in something like an Inconceivable every once in a while, which is eight people. And you know, that ups the difficulty there. So I don't want to do that every week because I think I would be much more distraught on a weekly basis, but it's fine to do every, you know, month to 6 weeks whenever I do it.
Yeah. It's not, I don't know. It's not a skill that I realize. Really, it's like, we want to make these things happen. And so you have to edit the podcast. And like, right. You don't have to, they don't always have to be intensely edited either, but the goal is to make something and to have it sound good and be audible. And the fact is that that means there's work to be done. It's not always super strenuous. My TV talk machine edit takes 10 minutes because I'm really just clipping off the beginning and the end.
Yeah,
if my garage door opened in the middle or his dog starts barking or something like that, I will note that and clip that out, or we have a connection failure, something like that. But otherwise, there's not a lot going on there. So that's a minor thing. But then sometimes...
Right. The Arrowcast is like that as well, because it's just the three... I'm going to line up the files, I'm going to drop them in, and I'm going to put in intros and outros. And occasionally, if somebody decides they want to drop a swear in there, I will bleep something. But that is about it.
Yeah, exactly. So, I don't know. It's funny. So there's intense ones and there's not intense ones. But it is a matter of... trying to put the thing together. And I mean, we're talking about your editor and the Word file and all that. It's like that last mile. The last mile of a thing is usually more technical, and but it's super important. And that could be like in a magazine back in the day, it was like the copy editors and the designers, and you get page proofs and stuff like that. It's the last mile. And for podcasts, it is that editing workflow part of trying to get it out the door. And sometimes I struggle with the idea of like, is this entirely necessary? Like, can people tell the difference? And one of these days I'm going to do or at least I tell myself one of these days I'm going to do a real A-B comparison that is, you know, here's what this thing would have sounded like if I didn't do anything. But like, I know it sounds bad and maybe people wouldn't notice, but I would know. And I feel like it would be beneath our standards. And I'll be honest, there are podcasts I don't listen to that have content that I really like because I just can't listen. And it's not like, oh, there's a hum in the background from a heater or something. That's not it. It's often like just terrible sound quality. It's an echoey room and somebody's far away from their microphone. But you know, in podcasting,
it's amazing what you'll put up with though, right? Like, I mean, I know you guys listen to the Flophouse a bunch, and there is notably bad audio there. I know that, I think you mentioned that you were also listening to Dragon Friends, as I've been, and they have a number of audio problems in some of their episodes just because they're also doing it from a live audience, and definitely a lot more challenging there.
There's a lot of issues.
But there's a lot you're willing to forgive depending on the content. It really depends.
Yeah, I think it's more as a creator of stuff, I want I take enough pride in what I'm working on that I wanna send it the last mile and be as good as possible.
Sure.
This is a bottomless pit. Like I've run into people who talk about spending huge amounts of money and time on things that are completely esoteric. And I try to guard against that. Like, I feel like noisy tracks deserve to be denoised, and super echoey stuff could probably have its echo brought down a little bit and make it sound nicer. But that's, and then I compress everything so things are at the sort of a similar loudness throughout. That's about it. Right. I mean, in terms beyond that, it's mostly me editing for content. On the Incomparable, when I do something like that, I'll take out like people bumping their microphone and all that, because that really annoys me and it's just extra noise. But it's mostly like getting rid of people's interruptions so that the conversation flows more smoothly. I'm sure I could release. Look, the Incomparable members get the bootleg, which I mentioned earlier, which is completely unedited and it's just the Skype track. Right. So the quality is terrible and people listen to that and seem to like it. So maybe I'm wasting my time, but I don't know. I feel like it's worth going the extra mile for the for the the final version.
It was funny to me because we were talking in the Incomparable Slack yesterday or something. I don't know. And our friend Moe's was mentioning to me in the Arrow channel. I was like, oh, did you like change your setups or something for the Arrowcast? Because it sounds way better. And I'm like, I literally changed nothing, Moe's. I have no idea what you're hearing. And so, but it made me feel good, at least, that it sounded good to him, I suppose. So,
maybe
that
Guy is in a less echoey room. Because we just had Guy on the Incomparable, and he was in a less echoey room. And that made a difference.
And I'm not, I think you already have hugely surpassed. Like, I turn to you for all my audio, like, engineering needs, because my skill at actually working with audio, you know, the actual audio quality of it is fairly low. Like you, I edit mostly for content.
Yeah.
You know, it's editing rather than engineering, because I don't know almost anything about audio engineering.
I know just enough to be dangerous, so that's my problem.
Yeah, so I have like a bunch of presets that you made for me that I basically apply kind of blanket and figure like, that sounds pretty good, you know, 80-20 rule sort of thing. But yeah, beyond that, I can tweak a little bit, but I honestly am quickly out of my depth on that sort of thing. So I'm always glad that people seem to, you know, think that it sounds okay enough. Every once in a while, you get people who complain about audio quality, but, you know, you kind of shrug and say, hey, that's the limitations of the medium or the limitations of my ability.
Sometimes it happens, too, where, like, somebody doesn't record or they've got a bad microphone or it's the wrong microphone. And I like to say last year when we did a Pod for Ham, the Hamilton podcast, and that was like a limited series. It was like every track of the show. And I used a bunch of guests that I had never had on a podcast before. And they were great, but every week somebody had an audio problem. And so every week it was, how do I solve this audio problem? And it was wrong microphone, bad background noise, horrible echo, dogs barking, cats meowing, you name it, it happened. And you just, you know, sometimes it's unavoidable, but you try. I think that's why I do a lot of the extra work that I do, is I'm trying to have it be as professional sounding, as good sounding as I can kind of reasonably make it. And reasonable is important, right? Because there are definitely times I say that I have other people do editing for me, but there was one, I think, Incomparable Game Show where I literally did not have time to put it together and nobody else could edit it. And you know what? I denoised it and I put the music on it and I essentially ran it unedited. And it's fine, you know, it's fine. I would it have been a little bit better if I had gone through? Well, sure. I have that feeling about podcasts other people edit where I'm like, oh, I would have taken that out. But, you know, it's fine. It's a judgment call. And you get over it. The same is true about writing stories and editing stories, that everybody's got their own take and you might do something different. And some of it is about your commitment to quality and some of it is about expediency of like, you know, I got to move on to my next thing. I saw this. This came up, I'm not sure it was the New York Times and the copy editors, but it was something like that where I saw a comment where somebody said, you know, I can't believe that they don't take the time to do this. And it's like, do you know what their budget is? Like, at some point, they can't take the time because they literally can't afford to take the time. We laid off copy editors at IDG, and it's not like the copy editors didn't provide a useful service, but we got to the point where we weren't going to have any copy for them to edit as our budget got cut. So in the end, the copy editors went. So sometimes it is that expediency, and it's not just people are lazy. Sometimes it's just like, this isn't something they have time for, or they have to prioritize, and they prioritize something else, because that sometimes that happens. There's only so much time in the day.
Yeah, and my biggest thing has always been this slight frustration with people, multiple editors requesting different different thing. Well, you know, for audio, I was thinking in particular, I had some co-hosts who do other shows and other people edit those shows, and they're like, well, so-and-so told me to set up this, you know, this way, you know, this levels, this filter or something, and they would send me these filtered files, and I would be like,
oh yeah,
no,
oh.
Never.
Are you talking about John Moltz? Is that who you're talking about?
I didn't want to name names, but oh. Yeah, we might say. And you know,
I had the same conversation with him, which is, well, yeah. I in order to get the noise out of my file when I record, John said, I have a noise gate and all this stuff going on. And what I told him is probably the same thing you did, which is just send me the file raw. I'll yes. do the fixing. Because what was happening is sometimes he would say things and you couldn't hear him because yeah. the noise gate had hit it and you can't get it back because he was
you
recording.
You can't get it back. That's exactly the
his
thing.
His original
right?
like, file was already modified essentially by his recorder. And it's like, don't do that. That's like having a Photoshop file where you only have the edited version. You can't right. go back to the original. Like
exactly.
If I have to yeah. choose, I choose the completely unadorned, messy original, and I'll fix it myself. But yeah, yeah. that does happen. It's that's really funny.
Yeah. So there's challenges there.
Anything else that you've noticed on the iMac front in settling in with it?
I'm still really enjoying it. It took me a while to find a desktop picture that was the right size / quality to for the Retina display, because I tend to use desktop pictures that are things I have taken, because I just prefer it to like the beautiful, like the built-in wallpapers are beautiful, but I like the person that like having a personal touch to it in that way. And so the only thing I could find that looked pretty good and was something that I had taken was actually a panorama that I had taken while in India of a tea plantation, because there was I would like this was the big adjustment for me going to Retina, is I would open these files that on my 21-inch iMac were so enormous. Like I'd open them in Acorn and be like, oh man, I gotta like shrink this down so I can see the whole picture. And I would open them on this and they'd be like in a tiny window and I'd be like, why isn't this file bigger? And it would take me a minute to do the math and be like, oh, that is actual size. Like, weird. Because you're so used to those pictures being enormous quality and they're so much smaller on the Retina display. So that took a little adjustment. In general though, no, I mean, it's been pretty smooth. I've started to just get much more accustomed to using it. I did not find the size as big I was worried it would be a big, huge jump from the 21 in terms of just seeming overwhelming. But I feel like I actually acclimated very quickly to the 27-inch size, and I don't feel like it's too big. And some of that is that it is not as, you know, the iMac, certainly they've made it look a lot thinner, and so it feels more compact in some ways than an older 27-inch model would have, because of the tapered back and all that. And so, you know, you put it up next to like even the cinema display I have, and you know, it's so much thinner, at least on the edges, than the cinema display. And yeah, so in general, I've been very, you know, pleased with it. I haven't felt like it's overwhelming. Honestly, the end of the day, because I used Migration Assistant and just dumped all my files on there, it's felt pretty seamless to me since day one. Like there's a little bit of logging into like a couple apps and making sure that some settings are correct. The bigger uses, like adjustments, have been with like the keyboard and the trackpad, just because they do feel so different from the old versions. And I'm still not 100% used to the fake clicking on the trackpad. That has taken some serious adjustment for me. Because it's good, and I'll get there, because in the same way that I did with the iPhone 7 and the fake home button, like to the point where I don't even really notice it most days anymore.
Oh yeah.
And then I give it to like my girlfriend and she's like, I hate this, why is there not a button here? And like you honestly, you get used to it after like a month or two, you really don't notice it anymore. So I'm sure that will happen with the trackpad too, but right now, because I'm still comparing it in my head to the older Magic trackpad, it still feels a little weird to me. And the keyboard, there are things about it I don't like quite as much, but this is also kind of the future of Apple keyboards, so I figure I might as well get used to it here, because sooner or later that's what it's going to be like everywhere, probably.
Yeah, probably so. I like the trackpad. I don't even think about it anymore. It's a click as far as I'm concerned, so
Sure. Yeah. I can totally see. You know, it's funny because I'm cleaning off the old iMac and erasing all the drives and everything. And I didn't have space on my desk for a minute for the wireless keyboard and the Magic Trackpad. And so I had them on my lap and I'd be like typing on my lap on the keyboard. And that's fine. And then I tried to click on the trackpad, having the trackpad on my lap. And that just does not work at all because of the way that the buttons on that are actually set up. So that was kind of a funny experience. As I mentioned in my article, I really love having AirDrop, and I know a lot of people have frustrations with AirDrop, but it's always, at least the new version of that that came out eventually, that was not the very first AirDrop.
Yeah.
In the last, 3 or 4 years, I've felt like it's actually been super reliable for me, and I use it all the time to just move, usually screenshots or photos back and forth. And I really love that. I think it's a great feature. I don't see as much inconsistency there as I do with some features that rely on similar protocols. Like, for example, my MacBook Air still does not reliably use the Apple Watch login. The iMac seems much better about it, but I don't know why or if there's a reason behind that, or it's just I've been lucky there. But the iMac has logged in pretty consistently with a watch, whereas my MacBook Air, at a certain point, if it fails, it just will never, it will be now I've kind of given up. I won't even try to unlock with the Apple Watch anymore. And so I don't know. I feel like I have to either restart or disenable and re-enable it and then just sort of cross my fingers. The iMac is, in general, I have no regrets about this. It was worth every penny that I paid. It's just great to have a ton of extra space. I was running out of space on my old iMac and all that, so it's nice to feel I've got a lot of breathing room now.
You get used to it fast, let me tell you.
Mm-hmm.
You're ruined. And Retina. Just Retina. Yeah, that Mac, is, right?
It is definitely harder to go back to the MacBook Air, although I will say that it doesn't hurt because I also feel like that my laptop screen is invariably dirtier than my iMac screen. So I'm just it's just dirty. I just need to clean it off. And then I think to myself, yeah, but then I'll notice how much lower quality it is. So maybe I'll just not do that for the moment.
Yeah. Every time I open my MacBook Air, I'm reminded, it's so little and cute. And also, oh God, the Retina, oh God. But it's
a little fuzzy.
It's fine. You get used to it. It's fine. It's just the Retina is nicer. It's nicer.
It is. It is definitely. If there were a Retina version of the MacBook Air, I would be there in a minute. Yeah, but
well, there's two, but they each cost $300 more than the MacBook Air. So, and there's MacBook, and I've been doing that a lot. I've been doing a lot of what should I get. I have friends whose kids are going off to college and or otherwise going into a new school, and they're like, they need a laptop. What am I going to get them? And I have been telling them all the same thing, which is really there is the MacBook and the 13-inch MacBook Pro with no touch bar. And you need to decide, and they need to decide what's more important. I mean, we were talking about podcasting earlier. It's also are they doing video editing? Because the 12-inch MacBook is not going to be good for that. But it's thin and light, and for kids who are not doing a lot of really heavy stuff, it's great because it's so small. The MacBook Pro without the touch bar, that MacBook Escape, basically, is kind of like the MacBook Air. It's not that much heavier or bigger, and it's got that kind of class of processor on it, and it's got the slightly bigger screen. It's like a lot like the 13-inch Air. So I keep telling people those are the two to look at, and then it's decide what your kid is really doing. If you want to buy them a new laptop for school, I mean, that's their call. And I've struggled with that with my daughter, right? Because Jamie is going into a set of classes this year where she's going to be doing more video editing. And right now she does video editing out here on my iMac when I'm not around, or I have to abandon so that she can do some video editing. And I think about that and I think, geez, at that point it probably has to be the MacBook Pro. And even with the Escape, is that enough power to do HD video editing? Probably. And enough screen size, because it can be really cramped when you're doing video editing on a laptop screen. But what you're gonna do. I'm not gonna buy her a 15-inch MacBook Pro with Touch Bar, nor do I think that's an appropriate like computer. And I've actually even thought like, well, I could get like an external monitor or something, and she could edit video at her desk. But that's right. Like an extra. I don't know. There's no great answer, but it all depends on like the kid, because if she wasn't doing all of this video stuff, I would be less concerned about it. Cause like her current laptop is a Chromebook that's 13 inches and is fine. But she's not editing video on it cause it's a Chromebook.
Right. Yeah. So there are limitations. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. Somebody wrote in asking about the difference between an iMac and a, you know, going back between an iMac and a MacBook Pro. You know, should they, which ones do they buy? And they're like, yeah, I'm just about ready to like flip a coin about it. And I was like, look, there's a simple answer to this. It's like, is portability important to you? If it isn't, and you're doing something that is, you know, highly intensive, get the iMac. I think that's pretty simple for me. Like the MacBook Pro is a great computer. There's no argument against that. But if you're doing something that is like needs as much processing power as possible and you need a big screen and you don't care about portability, done. If portability is an issue for you, easy answer again, get the MacBook Pro because it's the only option then, yeah. Right?
And if you can't have multiple devices in your life, then the MacBook Pro is probably the answer.
Sure.
Because, right. You know, it is flexible in a way that an iMac is not, despite those stories about people who bring their iMac to Starbucks.
I've seen one.
I have too.
It's weird.
The story that we got, I was on Tech News Today with Megan Maroney last week, and she had a story that was from England, and it was somebody on a train to London.
Yes, I saw the picture of that.
Who had an iMac on the train plugged in, and she was expecting the story to be like, have you ever heard anything like this? And I was like, oh yeah, I've been in a Starbucks in downtown San Francisco where there's been somebody with an iMac. Absolutely.
Yeah, I took a picture of someone in one of the coffee shops I used to frequent here who had brought his iMac in.
Sometimes people will do it where they've got a little basket that with wheels on it, and they've got like a desktop PC, like a mini tower in the basket, and then and they pull the screen out and they just put it on the table and they plug it in, and then they're like, I'm here with my PC.
I've yet to see anybody with like a CRT all in one. that would be impressive.
That would be incredible. The my thought about that is that it's somebody who can't afford another computer. This is the one that they managed to get.
Yeah.
I think in some cases, I think maybe in a lot of cases, it's somebody who is homeless, maybe living out of their car. And they've lost their apartment, but they had this computer, so it's the only computer they've got, and they're to find a job or whatever they have to do it. I mean, I'm sure there are other reasons, and that the lady with the iMac on the train in London, I thought to myself, well, if you're somebody who is commuting to another city some of the time and you only have one computer or something like that, I could actually see you doing this, right?
Sure.
Where I've got to bring my computer and I can work on the train with the computer and then I will come to my destination and I'll bring the computer out. There are reasons. It's amazing that people do that. I am kind of baffled, but you know, I think we're computer nerds often will be at a pretty serious position of privilege to look at this and say,
sure,
well,
yeah,
why don't you have a laptop? And the answer is, I think there must be a really good reason why they don't have a laptop. Otherwise, why would they be doing this incredibly weird and inconvenient thing? But this
is
the computer they have, and they have to work in this Starbucks. And so here we are.
That's certainly the most charitable answer, and I agree that it's always good to think about it from that perspective. The thing that always gets me, though, is that, of course, I live in a community with a lot of people who are, for lack of a better term, let's just say hipsters. And so I have definitely seen a number of people lugging in their big manual typewriters.
Well,
and
sure,
that just always strikes me as a like the straight up affectation. The same way that if somebody came in with a 1984 original Macintosh, plop that down in the cafe and start to work.
Do you know, Dan, if I own that cafe, I am paying somebody to be in the background typing on a manual typewriter at all times, because that would sound so cool. Clackety clack, 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 clackety clack, clack, clack.
It really draws them in too.
I'd have them shout. I'd have them wear a hat, and I'd have them occasionally shout, "Copy."
Yeah. and then, like jostle their way to the phone booth.
And
so
then
they
I changed the name of the
editor.
Cafe to like be the copy desk cafe. And we got
actually
something.
This is great. We should start a cafe. There's
oh,
one there's one that just opened near here called the Broadsheet, which I liked.
Oh,
that's a nice
see?
There's a good theme.
And every hour, an actor runs through. See, this is what cafes are
extra.
Like. No, no, the actor runs through and goes, "Stop the presses!"
Yeah.
And it's. I think we are on the forefront of entertainment cafes, where if you stay long enough, you get to see a whole little tableau
like
before
yeah.
you. Uh huh.
I like
it's
the idea that you'll
it's subtle. It's in the background.
Stop. I like the idea you'll stop the presses and all the baristas with the French presses all is like, what?
Yep. Exactly. Just for a moment. And then they
just
continue working.
And then they continue making their coffee.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's good. Well, you'll have a little fedora with like a press pass in it.
Dan, this is $1 million idea.
It will cost us $1 million and not make us any
yeah,
money.
It's a
is
loss
that,
of a million that, dollar yep. idea. Yes. Megan, did you not see the parentheses? They were silent around the $1 million, but I assure you they were there. Yep.
Well, if we ever want to throw away a bunch of money, this is one way to do it.
That's amazing. That's yes. Well, one of the baristas, we'll hire an actor because chances are one of our baristas is an actor. So they'll do
oh, yeah,
it.
That's a twofer.
They can put it on their CV. They can say, I was performing the role of editor in the broadsheet cafe production of newspaper where coffee is served.
All I'm saying is if they have cafes where there are cats that hang out, then this is really not a big jump at all.
I think there's a way better idea than the cat cafe, if I'm being honest.
I agree. It's far more sanitary, for one thing, I feel like.
I love cats, but, you know, a cafe where occasionally there's clicky-clacking of a typewriter in the background, and occasionally somebody shouts, stop the presses, or get me copy, or something like that, some old-timey thing, that's great. Or like... There's a dead body out on 4th Street. Send Johnson down there. Something like that.
Well, it's like going to one of those diners where they use all the diner slang or like 50s style
oh,
diner,
yeah.
right? Like right. It's the same sort of thing. There are those like 50s style diner, like people like sing and dance on tables too and stuff. Like
okay.
And certainly theatrical food things are not out of the question. Yeah. Or like the medieval time style, like go to dinner and watch yeah. jousting or whatever.
Well,
this is a thing.
You know, 20th century newspapers, it might as well be medieval times. So all right. You're flying away. I'm flying away. So I'm glad we did this podcast today before we go away.
Yeah, good timing.
Yeah. Well, thanks to everybody out there for keeping the lights on at Six Colors. We really appreciate it. It's been a weird summer where, you know, there's stuff going on, but not a lot. A lot of rumors, a lot of bubbling. So, you know, sometimes it's a struggle to find things to write about. But we're using betas and stuff, as we said last week. So we're working on processing everything that's going on in the background. So thank you for supporting us in our time of struggle with betas and things like that. Because quite frankly, if you were not supporting Six Colors, you know what we would be? We'd be actors at the local cafe. Nobody wants that.
No, that is not in our wheelhouse.
All right. Bye, Dan.
Bye, Jason.